All right, welcome everybody. You're in for a treat with Tony here. I'll cover a few housekeeping things. My name is Matt Stinchfield, the Brewers Association Safety Ambassador, and I'm here to welcome you to Attack of the Loch Ness Tagout Monster with Tony McCrimmon. Before we get to Tony, let me talk to you about silencing your phones if you haven't thought of that already. And Tony will take questions throughout his talk rather than backloading them. And he's got a little workshop project to do with you, too. So if you can fish out a pen or a pencil, if you have such a thing anymore, that would be great. Very importantly, when you ask a question, if you'd step up to one of the two mics in the aisles, that way we can record the entire thing for posterity. And finally, don't forget to go to the app at the end of Tony's presentation, and if you thumb down through this presentation to the bottom page of the app, you'll see a Rate This App button. It's very simple, three questions, and we appreciate the feedback. So I guess I've known Tony since 2013 when we founded the Safety Subcommittee at the Brewers Association, and we didn't have any members for that subcommittee. And Tony was recommended to me because some people at the Brewers Association knew about his antics. I mean, knew of him from his days working on the backside of the Great American Beer Festival. So the secret elves that dispensed the beers into randomly numbered cups for all the judges, that's something Tony's been doing for probably a couple of decades. And so somebody there knew that he had a professional safety background and encouraged him to join the subcommittee. He's been a great contributor to the subcommittee ever since then. And Tony has a background in a number of different industrial technologies, including things like fluid gauges and so forth, which are very important to brewing. He's also been training for many, many years, and he's got an interesting style and sometimes a very dry sense of humor. So just heads up, if you think that was supposed to be funny, then that's your laugh cue. And please do encourage a little laughter. And think broadly about questions you might have for him. And then I'll just sit back here and man the stop clock. We've got about 60 minutes. Thank you. Go ahead, Tony.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for coming. I will try, if you don't get to the microphone and have to ask a question quickly, I'll try to remember to repeat it so that it does get recorded. It's pretty important to be able to provide this information moving forward and make sure that everybody who can't get here, because how many tracks are there going right now? 7, 8? I don't know how many presentations are actually going right now. Too many, right? But this gives everybody else that couldn't get here an opportunity. Mackenzie also was trying to put up the link for the handout that you have, so you can go through this material after it gets posted to the website. You'll be able to go to this material and use the actual handout that you have in hand and do this at your brewery if you want to teach your guys how to build these programs and to do what you really need to do. And that's how I'm going to start out the presentation, is I'll give you the basics of what's necessary. We won't spend that much time on that. I really want to spend the time building a real procedure, okay? I came up with the idea that we should call this Attack of the Loch Ness Tagout Monster, because a lot of people think that lockout, tagout, and these safety programs that we have to have are real monsters. They're tough to do. Well, ultimately, technology. There you go. Actually, this really should be called Taming of the Shrew. You know, with all respects to Shakespeare, it should be Taming of the Shrew. And it's steam or heat. It's H for holes. Holes are valves and things like that. It's R for rotating, mechanical, mash rakes, all those kind of things. It's E for electrical, and it's W for water or liquids, okay? That isn't all of them, right? Because there's technically 10 energies that we want to think about controlling in lockout, tagout. But there's an easy one for you to remember that should cover most everything you're going to need to do in the brew house. Maybe this is not on. Oh, okay, there we go. So I'm going to go through, I kind of gave you the highlights of this. I'm going to go through how to build a procedure. I'm going to go through the basics of what you need, what your program needs to look like, and we'll go through this whole thing and put you in position to be able to do this in your own brewery. That's what my goal is when you leave, you can all you need to do is shoot me an email and say, hey, I got hung up on this step. What do I need to do to get through that? And you'll have it in front of you. We can talk about it quickly, and you have your program for your brew house and your piece of equipment, okay? An energy isolating device. What is an energy isolating device? That is a big definition that's used in lockout tagout. What is that? Does anybody know? That's whatever it takes to eliminate the potential for the energy to relieve itself or something to start up unexpectedly that can cause injury to the person that's involved with this work that's going on in the piece of equipment or around the piece of equipment. It has to be a disconnect. Can it be a switch? How many of you were at boot camp yesterday? What's a switch? Disconnects one conductor. What is a disconnect? Disconnects all connectors that provide power to whatever the piece of equipment is. Okay? All right? That's the difference. And it's got to be a disconnect. It can't just be a switch, because if it's a switch, one side always has power there. You can always be the link to ground. Okay? So it's got to be a disconnect. This is just not working right. Okay. Can it be an e-stop? No. And there's, even if you're from Canada, both Canada and America, by the CSA and by the ANSI, have definitions that talk about the fact that it cannot be an emergency stop. It didn't dawn on me. I was at a big project out at Coors Glass before I started with Xcel Energy just recently as safety director for three of their plants. I was at the project, and I was walking around talking to all my electricians' teams and looking at what they were installing, and all of a sudden it dawned on me that the disconnects that they were installing no longer had the hole in the bezel for you to put the lock in so that you could lock that switch in a position that nobody could return that from e-stop to full operation. And then I put two and two together, and I said, oh, the manufacturers are finally on board and have taken away that feature so that you can't mistakenly think that it's okay to use an e-stop as your lockout. Why can't you use an e-stop as your lockout? It eliminates the electricity. It's a switch. But what else? And here's where you see that it's a switch. Okay, that's a disconnect. And that's an e-stop. Okay? So your e-stop is just a single leg. Comes through to whatever you got power to, but there's your other leg sending the power back the other way, and you didn't disconnect that. But what's the other reason? There are additional hazards in things like valves that you need to control as well, which is why you've got to lock that valve closed or lock it open if that happens to be the situation. So what if you've got liquids? You have to stop the flow of the liquids, right? An e-stop doesn't do anything for your flow of liquids, okay? That's the thought process that you need to take it to that next level, okay? So, we're going to talk a little bit more about this aspect of assessing for your hazards and less of just being compliant with what OSHA says. Because those of you that have been through more and more of this training now understand that what OSHA says is a bare minimum, right? There are some things that are the bare minimum in our OSHA standards that just aren't acceptable because they don't work. They're not good enough for what we're really having going on. That's why we've got to assess for what the real hazards are based on your piece of equipment, right? Each individual one of you, because we're going to talk about mash tuns, and that's what we're going to write a procedure on, because everybody's got a mash tun, but everybody's got a different kind of mash tun, right? So the other thing about this is we can't rely on what somebody learned at the last brewery that they were at, because it's probably not going to work for my brewery, because my brewery is different than Matt's brewery, and it's different than your brewery, right? And it's certainly different from Alan's brewery. Isn't it, Alan? So there are basic requirements for your programs, okay? One of the things in there, number two, is written specific procedures for lockout, tagout of your equipment, okay? Which is the reason for this class. God, this is frustrating. You need to have a written corporate policy. What does your written corporate policy do for you? That's what gives you your guidance for what you're going to do moving forward, what the expectation is for your employees, how they're supposed to follow things, what the levels of training are that you're going to do, all those kinds of things. And it'll get down into to lower levels. Now, depending on what you want to do at your brewery, you may decide, and I don't care whether you're your owner, whether you're a head brewer, whether all you're a lower-level brewer, the decision at your brewery may be that any one of you in here right now are the only one that is allowed to lock out equipment and do the work on what otherwise would be live equipment, except that you've locked it out, okay? Or the decision of your brewery in your policy may be that 3 or 4 or 10 or everybody within the brewery is going to be trained to be able to lock things out and work on them, okay? That's where that kind of information needs to be found. Your machine-specific procedures, okay? And there's actually, if you go into the regs, because this is always something that everybody wants to have a discussion about, sometimes very heated, whether or not you can get away with an exemption for doing a machine-specific written procedure for lockout, tagout for a piece of equipment, it has to meet every one of 8 criteria found at CFR 1910.147 C4I. If it only meets 7, you still need to have a written specific procedure, okay? This is a big spot where people end up finding out that they've made mistakes in their procedures and programs. And it's cited quite frequently. Okay, so I talk about this concept that it's a $120,000 potential fine for not having a written procedure. But the worst thing is that if we're not lockout and tagging out equipment properly, then there's a potential for somebody to die, right? That is what is the important focus, right? Yeah, we got to be compliant, but holy cow, we kill somebody. I don't care how much it costs. I just lost a friend, right? And if they aren't following the procedures that we write, that's even worse. So we need to train people on these procedures after we get them. We need to train people on what our written program is, okay? The guidance here is that you need to make sure that everybody understands, so definitely give them a quiz. If there was any place that I'd say you should bring in somebody that's an outside expert to help you with a program that you're doing for your brewery, I would say lockout, tagout, and confined space are your two biggest places to do that, because there are things that get people killed all the time, okay? How long does the training need to be is the number one question that I always get. It could be a 5-minute discussion, right? It can be, hey, what we've done is we've just added this new piece of equipment to the mash tun, and because of that, the lockout tagout now is going to have an additional step in it. You know, maybe you didn't have a mash rake in it before, and now you do. Whatever it is, right? You've got to talk to people then about what the difference is and what you're going to have to do. There's an expectation that you do annual auditing. That expectation just recently changed. Used to be that you just had to audit your program and watch somebody do some work, and that was considered acceptable. Now you have to watch every person that's in your lockout tagout program perform lockout tagout, and you have to make sure they're doing it right. Okay? Why would you do that kind of thing? What's the real goal of that? It's to coach them, to make sure that they're doing it right. Because if they do it wrong, potentially somebody gets hurt, right? It's like when you coach your people how to brew properly, how to brew that special batch of beer that is your brand and everybody knows you by that brand, that product, right? You make sure that everybody comes in, brews that product exactly to the recipe and exactly to the final finished taste that you want to have. Same thing here. That's the concept you need to think of. Okay? All right. So what do you use to lock out and tag out things? Are there any requirements that it has to do something specific? It's a trick question, isn't it? Kinda. It has to be very difficult to defeat. Other than that, can you take a steel drum, cut it in half, put two hinges on it, put a spot on it for a paddle lock, wrap that around something and lock it? Can you do that? Absolutely. You don't have to go out and spend a lot of money. All you got to do is figure out a way to keep somebody from being able to open that valve that needs to be closed or turning on that switch that needs to be off or disconnect rather than switch, right? Okay? That's what you need to be able to do. Every person there that is doing the work and potentially could be exposed to the energy from this circuit, as an example, needs to be protected by their own lock. I have to lock this circuit off so that I cannot be energized myself by the power here, right? And there can only be one key to that lock, and I have to always be in control of that. Best place is in your pocket, right? How many people have heard an excuse for why I can't lock out? It takes too long. It's too hard. I got to go over there and get this stuff and come over here and do it. And then I got to take it all and put it back. It's so tough. No, it's not. Put the equipment that you need to lock out the piece of equipment at the piece of equipment. It's the rule of within reach, okay? You do that kind of thing, and all those excuses start to go away. The close-at-hand rule. Because if you don't lock out, the results can be pretty scary. And that Loch Ness tag-out monster will potentially get you. So, what's the other thing that we need to have? We need to have a good electrical safe work practice and procedure, okay? You need to have a program for what we're going to do in general to be good with electricity and safe. Commercial or industrial electricians only, I'm sorry. I don't know your friend who's a residential electrician, but I'm going to tell you that for the most part, they don't understand commercial and industrial electrical equipment well enough to do your electrical work, right? Anybody know how many thousand hours an apprentice, just an apprentice, needs to have before they can even take the electrician's apprentice test? Just as an apprentice. Depending on where you are, the major number that you'll hear, the most frequently stated, is going to be 4,000 hours. So that means that I've worked at least 2 years as a person learning without any kind of certification at all before I can even take my test. Okay? Those are the kind of people you want doing your work. And you never have anybody work on any equipment that's energized, because that can only be done by journeyman or master level electricians. That includes using a voltage meter. Why? I just shut the power off to that circuit. Why can't I use a voltage meter on it to confirm that? Because if I hit the wrong switch, it's energized. And that's a potential then for a shock injury or an arc flash or blast, either of which can be fatal. And certainly, if you saw some of the statistics from yesterday's class, there are a lot of people that end up in that situation that are professional electricians and still end up being bit. No one opens an electrical panel. You know, the photo that I had yesterday of the panel on the bottling line, that the panel was open in a washed-down area. It was all energized. You know why it was open? It's so that everybody could go in there and tweak all of the different pieces of equipment, because they all rotate and run, and right? You got bottles coming in. It's got to be synchronized with the rotation, and then the bottles have to go out. How else am I going to adjust this stuff? Because originally, when we did all that kind of stuff, and this is where I started my career, was with process control stuff, we didn't put the potentiometers and the stuff on the outside of the cabinets to control everything and be able to adjust things without going inside the cabinets. That's why we had those little screwdrivers, you know, the really tiny ones that looked like they were for Ken and Barbie. That's what they were for. And I opened things up, and I stuck my little screwdriver in there with 480 volts right next to where the potentiometer was. We didn't think about those things back then. That evolved as we had more and more of those statistical numbers of the people that ended up in the hospital, right? So I'm going to throw in a couple of real quick stories. Had an incident that occurred a handful of years ago. There was an individual that was a dishwasher at a restaurant. Okay, we'll change it a little bit. We had somebody that was running the dishwasher in your tasting room. And the individual went to break. And during break, somebody else within the business had to make a repair to something else on the same power circuit that the dishwasher was on. They had no lockout tagout program. All the guy did was go to the breaker panel, trips the breaker, and does his work on that circuit. Guy comes back from his break, does the same thing everybody does, and they go to throw their products, their dishes, their glasses, and everything in the dishwasher, hits the button, doesn't work. It's a common occurrence. They always have that circuit trip. Obviously, there's something wrong on it, right? If there's somebody else in another room working on something else, there's too much going on that circuit. It's a common occurrence. So the guy does what he always does. He goes to the panel, hits the breaker, and the scream is from the back room, because the other person is working on that circuit, and now it's live. So you've got to remember that the people that you teach the basics of your lockout tagout program have to be those people up front, too. It can't just be the brew house employees that learn this stuff, okay? Not that you're going to have them lockout tagout stuff. They just have to recognize that the equipment is there. Now, obviously, there were other problems here, We didn't have a program at this location, obviously. You can tell they didn't have anything, right? So there's got to be a program. Everybody's got to follow it. And then those people that have no idea what kind of work is going to be done on this equipment recognize that that's lockout, tagout, locks. I don't touch nothing here. As a matter of fact, maybe I'll go back on break again. So these are some examples of some of the things you can use. You want to try to find things that are very difficult to defeat. The one on the left, I'm going to tell you, for the most part, a lot of times you get those devices that go on the breaker, the switch on the breaker. Those things can be defeated pretty easily. Half the time, they're not going to stay on as soon as you put the weight of the lock on them, right? I would try to lock it out there. Another example, I think somebody told me what might be the issue in this situation, but we had a fatality a couple summers ago now, where an individual was energized by the fermenter that had become energized, and it was something to do with a problem with the solenoid on the chilling system on the glycol lines. And I think we kind of got it figured out what might be involved there, because there are some of the coils that you can get that do not have any kind of a ground on the coils themselves, and not to get into all the circuitry aspects of that, basically what happened is that allowed the system to be energized, and when he, let's see, is it, I've got five stories now, because as soon as we heard about this, people started to say that it happened to them. One guy leaned forward and touched two fermenters. One was energized, one was not, went through his heart. This guy was actually, multiple things going on here. He went up above and started playing with the valve because it wasn't working properly. It shocked him, and he actually fell off the top of the walk-in cooler. Fatal because of electrocution, not because of the fall. A lot of times it's the fall that killed them, not the shock. Come on, please. There we go. When we were here in 2014, that was our first year of doing the safety presentations, and we had our open house, and we were giving stickers to everybody to put on their badges to come to the open house and join in and be part of this community of people that are trying to be safer. Help build this safe climate that we want to have for everybody. And what guy says, let me tell you a story. I got out of my fermenter, my mash tun, and when I got out of my mash tun, out of the corner of my eye, I see a mop handle moving on the railing, on the stand, and it bounced across the control panel, and it hit the switch and turned on the mash rake because I hadn't locked out anything when I got into my mash tun. Can you see the control panel here? Come on. Anybody see what it says underneath the black button? Rake lockout. How simple, right? Do we need to lock out devices like this? Yeah, you need to control the fact that, first of all, you don't know where the vapors might be coming from as they travel in all these different directions. If you've got any kind of H2S problems in your drains or anything like that, and we never have those kind of problems, right? If you have excess CO2, you need to be able to control these things so that there is no way for vapors to move, there is no way for liquids to move, and even though you've got that triclover connection, right, you want to make sure that somebody who doesn't know that you're inside the mash tun comes up and starts doing whatever the next task is, and all of a sudden there's liquid coming in on you. That's when we talk about that permit-required space and we talk about the concept of engulfment, right? It's not just grain. There are a ton of devices out there that you can buy. You notice there's a two versions of tri-clamp devices. Hey, couldn't you take an old connector that doesn't work properly anymore to actually, you know, to do what it's designed to do? But couldn't you figure out a way to put a hole through it, put a lock in it, lock that onto your connection so that nobody can put anything else there? These programs don't have to be expensive. Be clever. Brewers are pretty darn clever. Be clever here as well. Build your procedure. It's got to be different based on the different equipment. Anybody have anything that looks like some of the things I'm flashing up here in the slides? And I'd flash them faster if the clicker would work right. Closer to a couple of other ones that you guys have? Okay. So we're going back to it. Taming of the shrew. Steam or heat. Holes, valves, whatever. Rotating. So anything that goes around like a rake. Electrical. Water, liquids, wort, whatever you want to use there. Okay. You guys can figure out little acronyms to use to make it easier for you to remember these things too. Use your own. If there's something that works better for you, use it. Okay? So, come on. All right. What are the hazards of each of the lockout points? Let's start with the top. Well, actually, let's not start with the top. Why do I want to start with number one, the heat source? Why would I make that the first number on my procedure? You want to give your mash tun time to cool off, right? So if you've got a device, remember, we're using the exact same thing. If this is a fermenter, a mash tun, a kettle, it doesn't matter what it is. What's number one? Figure out what number one is going to have to be on your procedure. If you don't have an external heat source on your mash tun, then that's not number one. Let's go to number two then. Okay? Number two. In this case, I've got the fill. So that's my hot water that's coming in. All right? Number three. Do I have a mash rake? At some point, you don't necessarily have to go in order of, like, I want to get this thing cooling down fastest. That's why I went to the heat first. Anything else could be the next order. Right? Number three, number four, in this case, we've got a device up at the top. We have grain coming in. Some of you may not have a device that's bringing the grain in. You're pouring bags in by hand. Okay, then you don't have a number four that is your conveyor that's running up your grain inside. Okay, number five is going to be your recirculation line. You've got both a pump and a valve. Do you need to do both? Depends on how your system is set up. For the most part, I would say yes, go ahead and do both. And then you know that you have no problem. But remember, that's why I said you've got to assess your equipment and how could something go wrong if something went wrong. And then figure out if you've got to do both of those. All right? Now, obviously, if I've got one of them and not the other one, that's why I just did five for both of those. Okay. Number six, I went CIP for this one. That's what I did. Seven, that's your line out. Okay. Eight, sparge arm. Okay. So we're going to lock that out. Make sure that nothing can come out of that because that's always hot water, right? For your systems, is there anybody here that's got a number nine that potentially we could add to this? Have you got another potential source of energy, liquid, something that we need to add to this and add to our procedure? Pneumatic pressure? Okay. All right. And I've been to a couple of breweries that have pneumatics to control valves as well. Is that where you're going with that? Okay. Yeah, so you can, what we do in the industrial settings and in the programs that I've worked with is we'll do both. We will go ahead and close that valve manually, lock it closed, and we will also remove the pneumatic source of air pressure. We will also lock that out so that there's really a more practical reason for that, and that's that we don't want a situation to come up where somebody's trying to force that valve open against that lockout and do damage. That's typically where we're really going with that, but it's redundant protection, and it does definitely protect us. Okay? Good. Thanks for adding that. Anybody else?
Question on this. Why would we have to lock out the outlet, number 7?
Backflow. Yeah, always think about backflow. And that could, if this was an electrical line and not a liquid line, think about whether or not you could have backfeed of electricity. Because, for example, a pump in this scenario actually had an incident like this at one of the facilities I was working at. What happened was the liquid was still in the vertical line, And we had nothing to control it. And at some point, the vacuum broke on that liquid, and it back drove the pump, which energized and turned the motor now into a generator. And now the generator is sending electricity at the guy who was in the process of rewiring a motor. Shocking development. Like he said, I got a dry sense of humor. Safety guy, you know. So we've kind of talked about what the hazards are of each. Didn't spend a lot of time on that because now I want you guys to pull out your handout. Okay? We're going to start for number one. Now, what I want you to do is not necessarily follow along with what my actual example is up here. I want you to think about in your head what your mash tun looks like, okay? And fortunately, one of our good friends, Doug Hinman, is not here because Doug basically has this huge bowl. And so he's got a hose that, you know, it's like brewing in the driveway, kind of a mash tun, and he moves his sparge arm on top of it, and he pours his grain in by hand, and he really only has one thing to do. No rake, it's all manual. He's got an outlet, you know. So, and he does have heat, so he's got two things for his procedure, right? So write your own procedure here. So we've got number one. In this case, I'm going to say inlet hot water. Everybody's got inlet hot water? You're not doing that by hand or with a garden hose? Okay. So you guys are a little higher level of brewer than I am at this point. Except I haven't brewed in ages anyway, so. Okay. What are you going to lock out? Do you have a valve? Do you also have a pump? Or is it gravity fed? Okay. If it's pump, now you have to look at whether you have a valve and a pump that you're going to have to lock out, okay? So for number one, write, if it's just a valve, write number one is lock the valve. If you have to go to number two and add pump, or if you don't have a valve there, because keep in mind, in some cases, you may not have a valve there, and the only thing you can lock out is the pump that's sending your water to your inlet, all right? That's why I'm saying you guys are going to have to look at your own equipment to do this. I'm just trying to get you started and rolling so that we've got a good idea what we're looking at when we get home. Okay? Come on, please. I bet you the battery's about to die. Do you have a heat source? Now, I screwed up because when I got here, I didn't put heat source first, but I want to put this heat source first because I want to let this thing start to cool down. Because the only reason why we're doing a lockout tagout on a mash tun is because we're going to go into it. and you don't want this thing to still be hot. Number one, potential for burns, but what's the other thing? Heat stress, right? Can't spend much time in there if it's really hot. It better not be. I've got a buddy who they had to change his career path in the Navy because he spent so much time in the engine room that he was having problems with heat stroke over and over and over again. The more you have it, the faster you succumb to it the next time, okay? So this is a really important thing to remember, to let this mash tun or any other hot piece of equipment cool down before you get into it. Inlet grain. Do you have a screw conveyor or something else that sends the grain? Do you have a hydrator as well? So, again, depending, you may have two devices that you have to lock out. All right? What next? How about the mash rake? Or do you want to put the mash rake right after heat source so that you're starting to cool down, which makes it a more comfortable entry, and you get rid of what might just be the worst potential thing that you could forget to take care of, and that mop handle comes down over the control panel and turns it on while you're inside. Okay, now I've got it out of the way right away. I don't have to worry about that one anymore. Okay? Not that you couldn't drown if you got enough liquids in there, right? Outlet hot wart. You asked the question, so you know why I'm taking care of the outlet hot wart. I don't want that somehow or another to come back out of the kettle into that mash tun while I'm in the mash tun. Okay? That's what we're doing that for. Recirculation. That might be part of what that pump is for, just depending on how your system is set up, right? Or is there something that you're disconnecting? For example, if you've got like the Rolex design, which is the manifolds on the front with all the triclovers, that's one of the manufacturers of that, then you're trying to control it there. One way or the other, think about what you need to do if you have recirculation like this. And you know what? That's a real good example of something. If you've got a piece of equipment that doesn't have recirc on it and you modify that piece of equipment and add recirc at some point, there's a change in your procedure, and you're going to have to make sure everybody's on the right page with the right new procedure to lock everything out. CIP, you're going to make sure that you don't end up with a chemical wash. You know, I know a couple of guys that at the end of the day, they need a chemical wash, but let's not do it this way. Here's a cool idea. How about using symbols? Liquids, beer, put those on instead of 1, 2, 3. You can have 1, 2, 3, but also use this as the key. Okay, down in the left-hand corner down there, it's electrical. That's our power. I got to make sure that I'm looking for electrical. That's my key to remember that it's one of my electrical lockout tagout devices that I'm using. Okay? Grain, so that's our grain inlet. Rake, rotating, could be the mash rake. How do you like the one in the bottom middle? You know what that one is? It's what brewers do all the time, and nobody that isn't a professional brewer doesn't know how much time is spent cleaning. Right? So that's your CIP. Have fun with this too, right? It's your cue to make sure you've done it right. You can have steam vapor coming up, or you can use a match that's lit, whatever you want to do to indicate the heat aspect. Okay, so we've gone step by step. What questions do you have now on what we've started as our 1 through 8 step by step? Anything? Shut off and lock the heat source. Everybody's got that? Does everybody have a heat source on their ton or not? Anybody not? Maybe I should ask it that way. Okay, so there's your example. If you ever add heat, though, right, there's your change in your procedure. Two, close and lock the inlet hot water. Everybody's got that. Boy, this is frustrating. Shut off and lock the mash rake. Anybody not have a mash rake? Okay. So if you ever get a new piece of equipment or you add, shut off and lock the grain feed system. Anybody got one of those? Anybody not have one of those? Okay. Close and lock the recirculation loop. Anybody not have one of those? Okay. So we've added that. Shut off and lock the CIP. Anybody not have CIP? Okay, so everybody's got that on their procedure. Close and lock the outlet out of the ton. I know everybody's got that because that's difficult to do otherwise, right? Those mash tuns are just too big and too heavy for you to take them and pour them into the kettle. Is your sparge separate from your inlet water? Which is a good question to ask. And then that's going to drive that aspect of it. Okay, are you good with what we've created? You have any questions about what we created and why we went there? Do you want to step back now that we've covered most everything? And I want to make sure that when we talk about each one of these, you understand what we're assessing as the hazard of each one of these, so that you recognize why we're going to lock those out. So this is the time if you want to talk about that and ask those additional questions about the different lockout points. Okay. Yeah, if you would, please.
I'm going to jump in ahead of you. Hey, Tony, if I can disconnect my grain inlet physically and just move it away so that there's no grain that could fall down in, do I lock that? Or just is disconnecting it enough?
We would still lock that. Okay, that's called in what we call that is we call that isolation, or we call it misalignment, or we call it daylighting, where you can look through a pipe and you can see daylight. Okay, what you want to do is you want to have a tag on it that indicates that that's the reason why this piece of equipment has been disconnected from where it's supposed to be, and you should put a lock on it. To make it difficult for somebody to go, oh, gee, I got to move this grain, and I'm wondering why this grain spout here is disconnected. Well, and then your grain starts to flow in, and somebody inside is going, hey, what are you doing? God, right? So, yes, very, very good technique and tactic to do that. Thanks for bringing that up, Matt. Yes. I'm good. How are you?
On our brew house, it's all automatic. So it's we have pneumatic valves for everything.
Okay.
Are we still okay locking out the main control panel, the air system, and the steam? And you still being able to do all our work?
You still want to lock the valves closed.
The physical valves?
Yes, and there should be something there that allows you to do that. Because all of those actuators now, unless you've got something that's a lot older.
I've got these Kieselmans. They're brand new, huge. They're awesome stuff. But
okay.
As soon as I shut down air or power to those, all those, they close in the. They are all in the closed position.
Right.
As soon as I do that.
Right. And the reason why you're going to guarantee that they can't be reopened again, either by somebody re-energizing air somehow, or and of course there are potential for failures, right? And the other reason why you want to do it is whatever that other hazard might be, like we're talking about the fact that in the case of that pump, when the vacuum broke, it ran down through because the valve wasn't closed. It kept it from running back down through.
Okay.
So it's all those other things as well. Okay. If you're dealing with something where, potentially it's a transfer to where you're going to have like CO2 or maybe you're adding oxygen to the fermenter afterwards. If we're cleaning a kettle and that's the line that's going to the fermenter and you could have, you know, something come backwards that way and cause you a problem. All those kinds of things have to be evaluated and assessed as well.
Okay.
If you get into a situation where you find that there is no way for somebody to defeat what you've got there, ultimately that's all it comes down to, right? You may be going a little above and beyond, but if you go a little above and beyond and nobody can ever get hurt, well, that's the whole purpose, right?
Okay.
So,
okay.
All right?
Cool. Thank you.
I forgot something, and that just made me remember, so thank you. Oh, that's because that's in this slide. That's why. Number 5 and number 7 on my example. We talk about how expensive things can be. We talked about the fact that you can do your own things and you can do them cheaply. Number 5 and number 7. So that's the valve that's the outlet valve to the kettle, presumably, Whirlpool, and the one that is our recirculation valve. How about we close those valves and you take a cable, because there are devices and you don't have to use those devices, you can use your own devices, take a cable, put it through the two holes, and put a lock on the cable. Did that just make it cheaper by buying another lock to lock out two valves at once? If you look at the way some of this stuff is set up on the Rolex, could you end up with creating a box that goes over all of those manifold openings, and you lock that box in such a way that you can't get to any of those openings? Sure you can, right? All you got to do is take the time to look at this stuff and say, how can I keep somebody from messing with it? That's what you need to do. Okay? What else? Any other questions? Go for it. I can repeat it if you want.
If you don't mind, I'll talk about it. Maybe I'll pick it up. So you talk about the potential of something failing.
Mm-hmm.
Do we need a double block and bleed, or would a locked out valve be good enough? Are we in compliance with just a locked out valve? Let's say like on our hot water source, or do we need a bleed on that too?
There is nothing that specifically says that you've got to go double and block and bleed. Double block and bleed is called out in certain situations and certain applications. And the fact that you're aware of that, if you do have a system that's set up where you could double block and bleed, as I'm going to tell you, let me sidetrack a second. Andrew, do you have any situations in your systems that are designed so well that they've got double block and bleed capability?
Not designed in specifically. But we do have a situation like steam, for instance, so we have a ball valve.
Sorry.
Yeah, pick it up a little bit. So we have, for steam, ball valve, and then for our double lock, we go back to the main steam coming into the brew house, for example, and then we bleed that out. So obviously we get rid of any residual energy
okay. In
that space, yeah.
Okay, so there's an example of a way to do it, but, you know, Breckenridge is a pretty sophisticated brewery, and if they don't have equipment like that, I'm not going to expect that most of the rest of you are going to have. What double block and bleed is basically I can lock this valve closed, and I can lock this valve closed, and I have a valve in the middle that allows all the pressure to bleed, and if something were to come from this side through and try to get by both of my valves, it's all going to go through the bleed valve to atmosphere, so it can't pressurize and push the ball out of the way. Because the seats and seals on ball valves fail at some point. You get leak through, which is my bigger concern there would be that it's CO2 and that you're having CO2 bleed by. You know, the liquids are going to go to the bleed valve and be out, but the CO2 then is going to collect in the area where people are working. Right, which is why CO2 and CO2 monitors are so important. But that's a great question. So under those circumstances, then, if you've got a situation like Andrew described where it's steam, that'd be a great one that if you can do double block and bleed or figure out a way to bleed off as well.
When our officer came through, they mentioned that. But But for something like us that's already plumbed in, adding that length to something and having a plumber do it or whatnot and making it food grade is a horrible cost. So
yes, it is.
But so a lock would be most of the time compliant. Yes, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it would be compliant. The main time that we really want to consider going to double block and bleed anyway is if we're going to be doing something that's going to be a confined space entry. And if you remember, we talked about the idea in the boot camp class yesterday about try to go out of your way as far as you can to never enter anything, right? Never do a confined space unless you absolutely positively cannot get around it.
That's
and avoid
with
it.
With our ladder town, we have a false bottom, so we clean that once a year. So when we classify that as a C7, that was a specific scenario in which they mentioned that.
Yep. Yeah, and it makes more sense now, right?
Okay,
hopefully.
Time for one short question, Tony.
One more question? All right. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much, Tony. Just a reminder for everybody, please find this presentation on your app, go to the bottom page, and give it a quick review. And thanks to Tony McCrimmon.
Thanks, everybody. Let's go drink beer. Safely.